Thank you for joining us, and this is a real example of an ambulatory reading. Welcome to LACMA. This evening, as Christina mentioned, we're thrilled to present a reading by Cherie Moraga and Elena Maria Veramontes. This evening's reading is co-sponsored by CalArts and, of course, by LACMA as part of the programming around the extraordinary exhibition, Phantom Sightings, Art After the Chicano Movement. I want to thank Michael Govan, Jane Burrell, Christina Cuevas-Wolf, and Aaron Sorensen, as well as the curators of Phantom Sightings, and they are Rita Gonzalez, Howard Fox, and Sean Noriega, for being so gracious and welcoming. I also want to thank the CalArts team, Stephen Levine, and the MFA Writing Program, particularly Alicia Manzano, Matt Timmons, Cole Cohen, Brittany Good, and Alma Birch for their help in putting together tonight's reading. Thanks for joining us, and please take a minute to turn off your cell phones and noise makers. So, as you know, the idea behind the reading was to bring writers into the gallery spaces in a way that creates the possibilities for intersections between linguistic and visual energies, which are guided but not predetermined. And speaking of not predetermined, we had thought the reading would take place in the galleries, but you'll have a chance to visit the exhibition again. Phantom Sightings is the first comprehensive consideration of Chicano art in almost two decades. In his essay for the catalog of Phantom Sightings, curator Sean Noriega informs us that in the American Heritage Dictionary, the very first words that appear after the entry on Chicano are usage problem. Noriega goes on to discuss the fact that in describing Chicano art, there is a similar usage problem, and that the artist of Mexican-American descent is often left out of the discourse. That's what makes this exhibition not only timely, but necessary. Writing is also necessary when it gives a voice to that which has no voice, and when it names experiences and conditions that we cannot feel indifferent to. We cannot feel indifferent to the work of Cherie Moraga and Elena Maria Veramontes. The structure of tonight's reading is that I'll give a brief introduction to Cherie Moraga, who will then read. And then I'll come back up and I'll introduce Elena Maria Veramontes, who will then read. And then Elena and Cherie will both be on stage for a Q&A. So if you feel questions brewing, jot them down, remember them so you can ask the writers directly. And then I'm also very excited to announce that after the reading, there will be a reception in the plaza. So join us for a drink and a cookie. And you can get your books signed and all of that. Cherie Moraga, I just want to say a few words about Cherie Moraga. She writes poems, plays, and essays that express her perspective as a lesbian Chicana born to a white father and a Mexican mother. She explores issues of ethnicity, feminism, sexuality, and gender in her work, and she weaves together poetry, prose, and memoir. She is artist in residence in the departments of drama, Spanish, and Portuguese at Stanford. I want to also tell you some backstory about her writing and her scholarship. In 1981, she and Gloria Anzaldúa co-edited the anthology This Bridge Called My Back, Writings by Radical Women of Color. They were unable to find a publisher for this book. Moraga then co-founded with Barbara Smith Kitchen Table Women of Color Press in New York. This Bridge Called My Back was published and was awarded the American Book Award from the Ford Columbus Foundation. This book brings together some of the clearest and most lucid expressions of what it is to be a woman writer of color that we have. The idea behind the book is to make available to everyone the stance of women of color, Black, Chicana, and Third Wave feminism. Moraga's 1983 book, Loving in the War Years, became the first published book by an openly lesbian Chicana. It explores the issues of multiple identities, Chicana, lesbian, feminist. Waiting in the Wings, A Portrait of Queer Motherhood, was published in 1997, and that gave a voice to an experience that had been unexamined. I also want to touch briefly on Cherie's plays, which are wildly imagistic, funny, radical, and gorgeous, and inflected by her highly lyrical and at the same time gritty language. The act of making theater is in and of itself a deeply political act. It addresses collectivities and it upsets them. It always either reinforces or challenges the status quo. Cherie Maraga's work always challenges the status quo. Maraga's plays, one of her first plays is called Giving Up the Ghost, and it begins with this invocation. Dedication. Don't know where this woman and I will find each other again, but I am grateful to her, to something that feels like a blessing, that I am in fact not trapped, which brings me to the question of prisons, politics, sex. And that's just the opening of the play. It's a powerful play about the attempt of a woman to reclaim lost parts and memories, and it is some of the most stunning language for the stage that an actress can speak. Her later plays include Shadow of a Man and Heroes and Saints. In these plays, Cherie Maraga meditates on family, religion, and inheritance. The incredibly theatrical Heroes and Saints is a play inspired by the fact that migrant workers were exposed to toxic poisons for years, and this exposure resulted in cancer and birth defects. In Maraga's play, her protagonist is a head. She is described as, quote, a head of human dimension, but one who possesses such dignity of bearing and classic Indian beauty that she can, at times, assume nearly religious proportions. Cherie Maraga is creating a new theatrical vocabulary that draws on the revelations that are contained in myth while entering into a critique on contemporary political horrors. As Brecht writes, art is not just a mirror held up to reflect reality. It's a hammer to smash it. Her other plays include Watsonville, Someplace Not Here, and Circle in the Dirt. In her preface to the second edition of these plays from West End Press, Maraga writes that, quote, Watsonville and Circle in the Dust document something of the people and history of this place and time in California, but they are not exactly documentaries because they refuse to end with the bitter facts. These plays are written instead in the spirit of what remains possible in a pueblo. Maraga reminds us that plays reflect the world as it is. They predict the world as it should be as well. Her latest play is The Hungry Woman, a Mexican Medea, and it is an exploration of the intersections between aspects of identity, particularly as a Chicana lesbian, but also in relationship to indigenous cultures in motherhood. Cherie Maraga explores the realms of the fabulous and the incredible, as well as the daily and the real, and she reminds us in her poems, essays, and plays that we are not trapped. She has been writing, witnessing, and creating a voice that continues to be heard and to be necessary. Please join me in giving a warm welcome to Cherie Maraga.
I'm very happy to be here, probably more than you know. I don't remember the last time Ed and I were together. I don't know if some of you were born. It's been a long time, and I think I really want to thank Bridget for the idea of bringing us to read together. It means a great deal to me. I think because, for me, a writer of my generation, I really need sisters. I just really need sisters when I'm writing. And a lot of times I feel they're really hard to find. And they're particularly hard to find more and more as, the arts get more and more commodified, and even among us and even among Latinos. And, so, when you find, a sister who continues to take such great risks in her work, I really feel less alone. So I am so personally grateful to Elena for her work on that regard. And so it's really great to be with you tonight. Thank you. I'm also just really happy to be here because of all my students. They're all viejos, yeah? Like, a lot of my time in Berkeley, you know, and they came back home to LA, which is great. And my family is here, and Elena's family is here. So that alone should have told them they were going to, you know, get the room would be too small. My son's here, and lots of good things. So gracias, really, it's really wonderful. Partly, I have read Elena's novel, her most recent novel, and which is a masterwork, in my opinion. And what really is wonderful about the work is that it's about place. It's about East Los Angeles between 1960 and 1970. And so I have been also working on the subject of place for some time and wanted to read about place in the spirit of sort of our conversation with each other. I've been working on my mother passed a couple of years ago, and spent the last 5 years of her life suffering from Alzheimer's, which is not uncommon, you know, as our elders live to be so old, you know, some of them, you know, so after 85, it's not an uncommon thing. But what it took me is to the question of, obviously, my mother's microcosm for me is her particular, as our matriarch and are really our memory keeper for my family. For her to lose her memory through a lot of things, it's deep questions for me, because she was our memory keeper, and our memory keeper could lose her memory and what. So there was a story of her particular loss of memory, but what it really did is make me aware of it. I sort of wanted to. I've been working on this memoir to sort of talk about that moment, but I realized that the real question was something even greater, which had to do with Chicano memory. And what I fear is our own cultural amnesia as Chicanos. And so this is, I'm going to read you, I grew up in San Gabriel, down the road a bit. And so it's a thing I never wanted to write about, which was that town. It's a town I always wanted to leave. Not as a little kid, but once I got in conciencia. And so partly I thought I would never write about this town, and this work has taken me to write about my place where I grew up. So I'm going to read two sections from it and skip a few things, but from two chapters. The first chapter is called The Other Side of the Tracks. On Indigenous Peoples Day 2003, my Mexican mother announced to my sister that the Anglo man who had occupied the other side of her bed for the last 55 years was not her husband. She refused to sleep with him again. She did not know who he was, she confessed, but she knew that she wasn't his woman, and he had no business in her bed. My sister was stunned. "Do you know who I am, Mom?" she asked. "Yes," she said, "you're my daughter. I have three children. But Mom, that man is our father." To which my mother replied, "He may be your father, but he's not my husband." Then she added, not hiding her distaste, "How could I have had children with that man?" I write this remembering the fresh opening that was a wound of my mother's life at 89 years old, a worker woman life from California agricultural fields to Tijuana casinos, to urban assembly lines, to suburban family kitchen, and back to assembly work again. It was so fresh an opening that I had no way to predict how long this delusion might last, or if the next day she would wake up and suddenly recognize my father as her life companion. That day she did not, and for many, many days and weeks to follow. That day she exposed the benign emperor in all his nakedness. This man was never her husband, she announced with indignation to everyone, her daughters, her last surviving sister, her doctor. She was done with the pretense. True to her conviction, my mother moved to the guest bed in the back of their small bungalow home. "It's the dementia talking," my father insisted, and of course it was. Still, my sister and I could not help but respond to the deeper message relayed in my mother's so-called locura. She was our mother, after all, flesh of our flesh, our soon-to-be ancestor, our tribal leader, our once fierce matriarch reduced to about 6 dozen pounds of bone-hard fury. As her Mexican female offspring, we saw in her the map of choices that were drawn out for us, too. We saw in her the locations of bitter regret we refused to inhabit, and the places of the same that we have inadvertently occupied in our own lives. She was our mirror. That day, the carnival magic house kind, distorted and exaggerated and fundamentally marvelous. She offered hope for change, that the human spirit really wants truth, that the human spirit really wants freedom, that the human spirit speaks through a thick wall of dementia to remember the heart's history more profoundly than any chronology of facts of who married whom and who about what children. Maybe dementia really was the gift of old age. We began as a mixed-race family of 5, my parents and their children, we 3 siblings born within a span of 3 years during that boom of babies following World War II. For the next 50 years, my mother, who was 8 years older than my father, would serve as a planet around which all of us and our near-hundred relations would hover like orbiting moons. What kept us all gravitating to that sphere of my mother's kitchen, aside from her incomparable chile colorado, was a shared sense of Akita's indefatigable capaz. Capaz. I write the word in Spanish, because all that I understood about Abel resided first in the Mexican body of my mother. My mother remains to me, even in death, emblematic of the most steadfast set of values, the foundation of which resided in the phrase, no te dejes, do not abandon yourself. Although not told to me in Spanish, it was later I learned that so much of what my mother taught her family were translations from a worldview conjured from an invaded and fractured Mexico, but one which proffered the wielded tools for our survival in Gringolandia. No te dejes didn't keep me from experimenting as we all imagined ourselves doing during the liberation movements of the 70s. But it did tell me when to leave the bar and the bed of the matter. It reminded me to step away from the cruelty of gossip and to learn when to hold my own cruel tongue. It developed in me a fierce judge of character, one as tough on myself as on others. And finally, it made it very difficult to lie. Valores Mexicanos. Everything about our upbringing as Mexican American children revered its elders. With elders, we learned to offer a glass of water, a cup of coffee, the last empty chair in a room. We extend our arm for them to hold as they cross the street, get out of a car, step into a bathtub. With elders, we learn to refrain from comment when we disagree, endure long hours of visita without asking to eat, and never refuse what is offered to eat, no matter how stale the saltines. With elders, we also learn that if we make ourselves invisible enough, they may forget we are there and reveal all. Stories of the power to conjure a past as shady, gray, and mysterious as the aging photographs that held them. Elders were to be honored at all costs, so when was the cost too high? The San Gabriel of my childhood in my parents' 40s and 50s was typical of most suburban Los Angeles towns of the 1960s, constructed from the American optimism resulting from the trauma and reinvigorated faith in democracy after the Second World War. The native origins of the region had long been abandoned close to extinction into the culture of landless Mexicans who now resided on the other side of the tracks of Anglo-America in the shadow of ever-expanding freeway interchanges. The dream of suburban America required its residents to believe that posted city limits, railroad tracks, and tree-lined boulevards protected them from the color of violence in the inner city. Throughout the 50s, however, as baby boomers were being born and then coming of age into the 60s, post-war hopes of social equality for people of color had been dashed by the ever-vigilance of Jim Crow laws in the South, rising urban poverty, the residual trauma and betrayal of Japanese-American internment, and the heartless working and living conditions of farm workers in California, Texas, and Arizona. In the case of San Gabriel, color had always been there, and the Yuko Aztecan descendants now carrying Spanish surnames on the south side of the tracks. By the 1960s, those same Indians and their Mexican relations from the south had evolved from filero toting pachucos of the 40s to become khaki-clad cholos and poured over the hills of East Los into the Valle de San Gabriel. Soon after, they, along with the working-class Catholic schoolboys, started coming home in Army Corps body bags, and a president, and a would-be president, and a Baptist minister, a Baptist freedom preacher, and a freedom fighter, and a freedom fighter, and another freedom fighter got shot dead, and the suburbs, I came to learn, would not protect us, but I learned that later. In 1961, the Anglicization of San Gabriel was still in full swing, with our family was the first of the Moraga clans to move there, although we are not the first to bear the name in the region. Landing on the other side of the tracks, but south of Las Tunas Drive, the dividing line between us and the more affluent Anglo homes to the north, 205 Unipero Serra Drive sat in a kind of holding zone between Ringolandia and Mexican Indian inheritance of San Gabriel. The main drag through town, Las Tunas Drive, in many ways reflected the fiction of the American dream, that the culture of any place in America could be imposed upon a city without regard to the history or culture of the majority of the inhabitants. In its heyday of my childhood, Las Tunas Drive featured the Edwards Theater, where for a 25-cent admission ticket, I could cast my pre-adolescent eyes upon Latina-esque Suzanne Plachet's bold cleavage, magnified on a big screen. Just down the block from there was the Las Tunas Market, a three-block, three-times-a-day walk from our house, which my sister, my cousin, and I obligingly trekked in errand for my mother and grandmother. Their wookie boyfriends lingered on 10-speed or stingray bags, straddled across banana seats like wannabe Hell's Angels. The market was eventually replaced by Julie's Bakery, which had come to replace the helmsman, who had each afternoon delivered to the front of our house chocolate dipped donuts and eclairs drawn from the 6-foot-long drawers opening from the back of the Helms Bakery van. I remember a liquor store on the same street which survived the closing of the market during my college years. Their underage boyfriends sauntered in without ID for a bottle of Annie Greensprings, a cheap soda pop wine that tasted like Kool-Aid and perfectly suited the taste of working class just last week bubble up drinkers. There was also the fast food Tasty Freeze that was not tasty, but provided to my brother the one job he had briefly during high school. Then he gave up summer jobs altogether for August football training and college scholarship aspirations. Just down the street from the Freeze was a ranch steakhouse, which we frequented on a very rare occasion of extra cash in the house, and a hardware store where some 40 years later, I would buy a galvanized metal tub in which to give my 88-year-old mother a bath. There was a local library, the size and prefabricated look of a jump strip market, which provided my sister and me with infinite distraction during endless summer months, coloring a new section of the mimeograph bookworm for every book read. A block down from there stood a pharmacist-owned corner drugstore where I worked as a teen for $1.50 an hour when the minimum wage was $1.65. This is also where I snagged my first and only can of spermicide foam just in case the condom didn't work. Crossing city limits a few miles to the west, Las Tunas Drive became Main Street, Alhambra, with a Woolworths 5 and Dime and a Learner's Dress Shop. The 25-cent bus drive soon replaced our trips to Main Street, downtown Los Angeles, where I had held onto my mother's straight line skirt as we rode at a near 90-degree angle the famous Angel's Flight. A vernacular railway on the Bunker Hill, it was leveled in 1969, as were most of the Victorian mansions in the area, to make room for 50-story glass high-rises. In short, as a burgeoning suburb of Los Angeles, life along Las Tunas Drive and its environs was in many ways what it was intended to be, ordinary, a kind of anywhere USA. What was not ordinary to me was that San Gabriel was to provide the final stomping ground for that band of Mexicans, once Españoles, once Indios, that our familia would never Mexico lived next door to us in the body of my forever-aged grandmother. By the time Dolores Rodriguez Morada had already spawned a full tribe of more than 100 descendants, the majority of which had moved to San Diego Valley. Following my mother, Elvira, whose youngest siblings had followed her in pursuit of a more prosperous life, Dolores left the South Central Los Angeles already plagued by the interracial conflict, black against Mexican, against newly arrived Asian immigrant that still afflicts it today. Grandma had hesitated to make the move until that fateful afternoon when poor eyesight reconfigured the light-skinned black man who entered her bedroom as her son Huerto. Holding a knife to her throat, he threatened her to not make a move while he ran off to the rest of the house to scavenge for cash and anything he could carry inside the deep pockets of his trousers. In the meantime, my grandmother was already in her 70s, crawled to the open window of her bedroom and dropped a good 12 feet to the crab grass beneath her, running to her youngest daughter's home for refuge. Our San Gabriel Valley, Montebello, Alhambra, Monterey Park, and of course San Gabriel with the mission and its Catholic schools, became our own familial cosmos of first and second cousins, aunties and uncles, niños and niñas. To live in proximity to my grandmother was to daily remember an America before Anglo intrusion. Born in 1888 in Sonora, Mexico, but baptized in Florence, Arizona, the document for which she used as proof of U.S. citizenship. My grandmother remained faithful to a position as surviving matriarch of La Familia and to her Mexicanism until she passed in 1984. The Mexico my grandmother brought to my daily life was one of a Sonora desert of covered wagon, entrepreneurship, and the high, dusty drama of an untelevised West. She riding shotgun without shotgun at my grandfather's side as they pulled up into a Yaqui Pueblo, pots and pans and kitchen utensils clanking their arrival. The Yaqui family sits silently in a circle around the mestizo vendors. My abuelita grows impatient. Vamos, no quiere nada. She snaps impatient at my 20-year-old grandfather. He urges her to wait and watch. Many long minutes pass, until at last one man stands and approaches the wagon. Moments later, the whole community follows. Business was good that day for the newlywed Morales. The Mexico my grandmother brought to my daily life was the length of her fingers threaded into the mouth of my anti-war folk guitar. She sang songs I do not remember the words to now. Her voice, a Chavela Vargas gravel, as she plucked at the strings with arthritic fingers, having long lost the finesse of her girlhood musicianship. Her family were musicals, she told me, in her broken English. And yes, once I remember seeing such a family portrait, the brass instruments resting across high-water woolen trousers, violins pressed against proud chests. The Mexico my grandmother brought was a familial memory, sleeping beneath the blonde furniture headboard that held the small retrato of her long-dead mother. At night, with our evening prayers, we kissed the pursed mouth of the small sprig of woman, clad in a black high-collar dress, a chonguito atop her head. Bisabuela had died in her 90s, as my grandmother would in the decades ahead. My abuelita's mourning of her mother had never lessened, as I watched her become the same pursed mouth figure in the photo. The same figure my mother would assume in the last months of her life. Me too, I imagine one day. Me too. In this world of extended familia, primos, abuelita, and tios, I remember the world of play. I remember pretend games and smog and chlorine-filled lungs that ached with each full-chested breath on the balcon from the city plunge. I remember peanut butter and jelly sandwiches and concentrated lemonade from cans and my mom at work in the electronics plant and long hours of trying to find something to do. I remember the ever companionship of my sister and prima hermana Cynthia, Nino's small-sized pizza for $1.50 and RC Cola pints, going to Nan's Cantonese restaurant after collecting my tia Tencha and mom from an hour's worth of Friday night paycheck beers at the Skip Inn. Our heads pyramid style at the back alley screen door, My sister Cynthia and I would peer into the smoky dust of the afternoon bar, trying to distinguish the silhouettes of our mothers. I always checked the feet first. As her eyes adjusted to the dark, my Theodentia's iridescent feet would gradually come into view, propped up upon the leg of a bar stool, covered in her coveted pantuflas. She suffered from merciless bunions, and after 8 hours of assembly line work, the fluffy pastel slippers became their own kind of podiatric sanctuary. They were hardworking women who would wave us off with, "We're just going to finish this one last beer, mijita." And true to their word, even when the beer extended itself into another, they would finally emerge in good humor, smelling of hops and cigarettes and electronic wire. What else do I remember? I remember working hard with my hands, even back then as I do now, hammering and fixing and taping, peeling back tiles onto the crumbling bath shower wall and kitchen sink. I remember trying to please my mother, but mostly I remember feeling like we were always just one step ahead of this appearance. With the theft of local shopping through the invasion of mega malls of the late 1970s, the Las Cruces driver, my childhood threatened to disappear altogether. Outside of the obligatory banks and a renovated post office and library, only a handful of small businesses survived the corporate takeover of food stores, cinemas, and eating establishments. Any place USA had in fact begun to look like any place. I watched this gradual attrition of what distinct culture remained in the area of San Diego throughout the last years of my parents' residence there. At the turn of the new century, on my visits down to my home in Oakland to see my parents, our regular trip to Bandy's, a coffee shop with Mexican cooks run by a Chinese woman who called my parents Mama and Papa, proved to be the highlight of the Las Cunas Drive experience. Catering to an aged Anglo-Mexican clientele and some member Chicano familias, the budget meals provided a kind of landing spot for my parents, where reliable routine far outweighed the need for quality taste. At the same time, in those final decades, San Gabriel had gradually become home to a near majority of people of Chinese diaspora, with a large Taiwanese population moving into the upper middle class northern San Gabriel. To the south along Valley Boulevard, once the site of Chicano cruising in the 60s, the area now serves as a main commercial corridor for mainland Chinese as well as those from Southeast Asia. The change in demographics did not occur without my mother's comment. Once in the mid-90s, passing the site of the old drive-in theater on the corner of Del Mar and Valley Boulevard, which had been transformed into a huge Asian shopping mall, my mother says to me, "And we, meaning Mexicans, have been here from the beginning and we don't got a damn thing to show for it." Did she feel the same way about Anglo incursion? I wondered, but imagined not, since Anglos had already reigned landlord in Alta California since the generation before her parents' birth. To my mother, Anglo incursion was law and centuries beyond even my mother's quiet protest. Anglo incursion was also the intimate matter of family, my mother being the first of her generation to invite one into her marriage bed, setting a trend for the generations that followed. By the time I am closing at my parents' home in 2003, the demographics of my grandmother's descendants have changed as dramatically as that of the San Gabriel Valley itself. Her baby boomer grandchildren and their children have overwhelmingly made it white and have moved further and further east away from Los Angeles, with a handful of the more affluent having moved into the upper middle class areas of Orange County. For the most part, only a few surviving elders remain in the homes with newest children. We had always lived on the other side of the Mexican tracks, my mother made a point of saying, the way she also insisted that as a little girl, her family never sat in the Mexican section of the movie house. We were a different class of people, she was fond of saying, referring to herself and her 8 Spanish-speaking siblings. The fact that throughout their childhood, my mother, aunts, and uncles were systematically removed from school by their contractor alcoholic father to hire them out as farm laborers did not, in my mother's mind, bind them economically nor culturally to the rest of the Mexican immigrant population. But you can't really escape Mexicanism in California. I San Gabriel, where single-family houses have been replaced by working-class particleboard apartment complexes squeezed into single-family lots, parking garages as foundations. Mexicans began to return en masse to my childhood neighborhood, and my mother's position there began to assume a kind of organic logic. She ended up where she had begun, if not begrudgingly, where a young married neighbor referred to her as La Señora, and she assumed the role of La Vecina Anciana and resident consejera for abandoned wives and wayward children. Then I'm going to do this one last section, then it skips a little bit and continues to talk about San Gabriel later in the memoir. This is called El Camino Reales. Ironically, in 1977, as I stuck to the metal wheels, my green Volkswagen Bug, and headed north on 101, following in the highway wake of thousands of 20-something-year-olds in pursuit of liberation, I had no way of knowing that it was returned, I thought. Almost 30 years later, as I closed at the house of my mother's history, it was returned that I sought again. For my history, too, was embedded there between the piles of mixed-matched sheets and mildewed cardboard boxes stacked against crumbling stucco of the garage wall. As I pretended to search for my mother's remains, it was my own buried remains I sought. But how do you dig up amnesia? Diggers. Digger Indians is a name the anthropologist first gave to the indigenous people of California. A no-name people in their estimation, the Tanga were denigrated to the image of broken nails scratching at equally broken earth in search of supper. And yet this was exactly how I felt scouring my mother's home for a sign of palpable memory, a sign that we were a people that predated suburban sprawl, mini-marts, and my family's in-mass denial that we walked in cultural mourning. Today, unlike so many of the other California mission towns that dot the coastline and the interiors along Nicolás Serra's history of El Camino Real, San Gabriel has never made it as a tourist town. Without the wind-sculpted coastal cypress of Carmel or the vibrant city pulse surrounding Mission Dolores de San Francisco, La Misión de San Gabriel is only its own contradictory history to barter, bounded by small baked asphalt parking lots and the ever-construction of apartment complexes. The three or four blocks containing the Mission's plaza and historical walk offer little in the way of tourist amusement. The arcade shops contain mostly a Mexican restaurant, seldom open, and a catering supply business, its plate glass windows displaying a few dozen folding chairs and banquet tables, awaiting the next working class wedding or quinceañera. There's not a real out there for miles. You have to go to neighboring redeveloped Main Street for that, where the Five and Dime closed up a few decades ago. Tourist brochure, San Gabriel Mission. Saludos, amigos. Here in those God-based surroundings of Mission San Gabriel, we enter another world, a world of peace, harmony, of man's visible adoration of God. Here trod the valiant Spanish explorers, the jovial spirited Mexican, the benign Indian, and the adventurous Americano. Here you are welcome, forget your cares and troubles as you relive the early days of the Western world. Wander as you will through the age-old gardens, picturing in your mind those round-robed friars and gentle aborigines who toiled so patiently within the shadow of these walls. My sister's son and I walk about the mission grounds. The garden displays what I love about Mestizo, California, the meeting of Mediterranean and Native American landscape, bougainvillea climbing over adobe walls, the muscle thrust of elk through grapevines, throwing arches of shade over broken cobblestone pathways, the petals of succulents bursting like flowers, the desert memory of maguey and nopales with trunks as thick as torsos amid mounds of goldenrod and poppies, the wafting scent of anise and yerba buena bathed in the midday sun. I allow myself this moment's reprieve to imagine an exchange between races as equitable as a coexistence of plant life in this jardín. the integral beauty of each enlivened by the contact. I am as romantic as the next tourist in this regard, longing to imagine a less brutal past, but spirit won't have it. My sister is physically unable to enter the mission's baptistry, in which resides a sign saying, "The same sterling silver baptismal shell where the first Indian received the waters of everlasting life." "I can't go in there," she says, and means it, literally. I remember my friend Barbara, an African-American, telling me the same when once wandering down the streets of New Orleans toward the outskirts of town, she happened upon the site of a once slave auction block. Spirit won't have it. We walk the cemetery of memorialized afterthoughts that disguise more than two centuries of revisionism. The grave marker that cites in English, "Antonio, first Indian buried in the cemetery, October 20th, 1778. And the life-size crucifix, quote, "raised in memory of the 6,000 Shoshone Grabalino Indians buried within the confines of these stone walls, R.I.P., end quote. But they do not R.I.P., because it was a crucifix that dug their graves. Who was Antonio, and what was his real name? What were the names of the 6,000 neophytes interned and interred within a quarter square mile of mission grounds? There is no reconciling these nameless deaths. But unbeknownst to mission chroniclers, Antonio's Indian descendants have not disappeared. They are the modern-day Chicanos of the region who claim those 6,000 neophytes as ancestors. In 1994, through the efforts of the Gabalina Tonkin Band of Mission Indians, the city of San Gabriel passed a resolution recognizing the Gabalino Nation as the Aboriginal tribe of the Los Angeles Basin. A tiled mural acknowledging the contributions of the nation stands in the same neighborhood park we used to frequent as children. For once stood a kiddie playground where my mother's grandchildren had bounced on pastel-painted seals attached to coiled springs in the ground. A replica of a Tonga village structure has been constructed. Surrounded by native plants used for medicine, baskets, and clothing, the site recognizes a scarcely documented history that predates mission days and acknowledges Simbatna as the original name for the area. There, a community of some 150 people had made home. 200 years later, my family did the same. I have no papers to prove that my family had moved to San Gabriel in 1961 as a site of return. Still, in recent years, I've wondered over a curious historical occurrence. The Bonanza Trail, which my could-be ancestor, Lieutenant Jose Joaquin Moraga, charted with Juan Bautista de Anza over the Sonora Desert through San Gabriel and up to the establishment of the Presidio of San Francisco, absolutely parallels my own family's journey of migration, and in particular my own from Sonora to Arizona to San Gabriel to the Bay Area. If there is reason to believe that Moragas from which I am descended may be remote distant relations to Jose Joaquin, then we're also related to his son, Gabriel Moraga, who by the early part of the 19th century garnered accolades as an Indian killer. He is single-handedly credited with repelling an Indian revolt staged against the San Gabriel Mission in 1811. There is better reason to believe, however, that we are more directly descended from the lineage of Moragas who remained or returned to Sonora, since my great-grandfather Moraga and grandfather Moraga were born there. In either scenario, my Spanish ancestors at some point intermarried or had sexual unions by force or agreement with my native and mestizo ancestors, resulting in the mixed-blood band of California Mexican Americans we are today. In either scenario, after World War II, in gratitude for the safe return of her sons, my grandmother Rodriguez de Moraga traveled with the Tohono O'odham and Peregrinación from San Javier del Bac Mission to Santa Maria Magdalena Mission in the heart of Sonora Desert. Did she share the Tohono bloodline? I don't know. Did their cultural worlds cross, intersect, and blend? Yes. I am a displaced mixed-blood Chicana, whose native origins on my mother's side may land me somewhere in the desert of Sonora, and at the same time in the once paradise of the Tonga lands of San Gabriel, California. For me, as it was so many Chicanos who cannot point to the exact geography of their origins, there is something to be found there in those sites where memory calls us, in spite of the Indian amnesia force-fed to us for centuries. We return as refugees to that foreign landscape that we somehow recognize as home. It wasn't until the last decade of her life that my mother admitted in voz alta what I already knew from the character of her Mexicanismo. She practiced that she was indeed India, without tribal name or entitlement, and just as Alzheimer's was beginning to make itself known in the map of my mother's brain, the geography of that remembrance returned to her. Maybe in the same way she had responded to her half-century-old marriage, my mother was finally done with the pretense. 9 months after my mother's death, my sister, son, and I will pass by my parents' home in San Gabriel just to take a look at it, just to see if there's something left to be found there. We had, in fact, left an old empty trunk, a rusty blue wheelbarrow, a small end table, which I had hoped to bring home with me when I had the chance. The chance never came only 2 years after dismantling that house, when I finally found the heart to return physically to that once location of home. As we make the U-turn across the four-lane drive to pull up to the front of the house, we spy an older, well-groomed gentleman, khaki work pants and button-down shirt, rolling up a garden hose in the blacktop driveway of the house. The place looks the same. Nice. Nicer than my parents' last years in the house, where gardeners tended toward mediocre maintenance because of, without my mother's constant regañadas. The elder holds the end of the hose and watches us with a sign of suspicion as we park and step out of the car. He must be the owner's father, Joanne says. We approach. At first, the conversation is reserved and awkward as we try to explain who we are, and then relief passes over the elder's face when, struggling with his English, Joanne and I shift to our less than perfect but perfectly comprehensible Spanish. He apologizes, "No, that stuff has been discarded a long time ago since no one came to get it after so long." We apologize that we were so delinquent and assured him several times that we understand why the things were given away. No se preocupe, I assured him. Recovering the abandoned items turned out to be the pretext for the visit. For what this jardinero guardian angel gave us mattered more to us than any rusty wheelbarrow. He was custodian to that land and my mother's memory. The day before we had gone to my mother's gravesite, a small plot of thick Bermuda grass, neighbored by thousands of other Spanish surnamed gravestones. It was a celebration of sorts at the Resurrection Cemetery, where familias had brought coolers and lounge chairs and umbrellas in anticipation of the high noon sun. Folks hung out, eating, praying, weeding the grass around the graves, washing them down with rags and small buckets of water. We too, with my father and my mom's remaining brother and sister, prayed and sang and told stories about my mom, and it felt good for all of us. But it wasn't until we landed back in San Gabriel upon that garden of 75-year-old rose bush, blossoming camellias, bougainvillea, and poinsettia did my mother's spirit present itself. My God, she was there. Standing beneath the canopy of century-old blossoming jacaranda, it came to me that we are as much of a place as we are of a people. That we return to places because our hands served as tender shovels in that earth. That those yellow peach and cream-colored roses, that wild yerba buena, those lavender plants covering the earth like cloth to catch the steady drop of rose petal and leaf, this was my mother's constant site of comfort. How egotistically we believe that when people die, they leave their spirit with people. Yes, I carry my mother's DNA, but she left herself equally in this lot of earth where she had always offered her best self. Without tombstone marking, without plaque, without store-bought flowers stuck into the mouth of cast-iron vases dug into the graveyard earth. This was more surely her earthbound site of remembrance than any cemetery. It is a warm September afternoon, and I am digging through books on Gravelinos, books on the mission system, books of my own, scribblings of remembrance and regret. I search websites, library databases, sift through photographs of Californios and the first native Angelinos, and computer screen facsimiles of Spanish baptismal records of the missions. One distinguishes itself in that it is the first recorded baptism of un indio in la misión de San Javier. I examine it line by line. On the same manuscript of calligraphic letters, I spy the name Moraga. I can barely make out the fading script, which could read, Bautice solemna otra adulta como 40 años, viuda, su consorte gentil y madre de los niños. The two children of the widow are named Joseph Joaquin Moraga and Maria de Luz Moraga. It is signed by Ignacio Stern himself in November 1778. There is no religious justification for a Spanish mission system which affected a genocidal practice of slavery, dislocation, disease, and rape against Native Californians that laid the groundwork for two centuries of oblivion that followed. There is only grief. There is no justification for the betrayal of the promises of the Mexican independence against the Tonga, the Chumash, the Coahuila. There is only grief. Since the arrival of the Gringo in the mid-19th century, it is first and last grief that has whitewashed the entire history of Native California, even as it walks still in the bodies of its Mexican descendants. There is no justification, but there is so much need for reckoning. And for me, and maybe for my mother too, there is a need for return. My mother left herself planted there in those rose bushes in the once Tongva village of Simbagna. That's it. It was she who returned the Moraga clan to San Gabriel and its surroundings in 1961. I return to these words. It stirs something, an unearthing of sorts, both Indian killer and Indian. We return to recover, uncover what got lost there in that country of ghosts.